Jennifer McCormick opts not to run for re-election. Criticism lobbed at campaign contributions to Connie Lawson. That, plus a new trade deal and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 5th, 2018.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Indiana Schools Chief Jennifer McCormick announced she will not run for a second term in 2020. Republican Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick says politics are to blame for her decision not to run for re-election. Lawmakers in 2017 made the superintendent appointed rather than elected beginning in 2025. McCormick calls discussion over whether she would be eventually appointed to that position distracting noise. McCormick also criticizes that decision to eliminate the superintendent from the ballot. She says Hoosiers should have a voice in education policy. Days later, McCormick also announced she will no longer serve as the head of the State Board of Education after January, when members elect their chair. McCormick says the governance structure in Indiana education is unhealthy. What effect will McCormick's decision have for education governance in Indiana? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Leslie Weidenbender, managing editor of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly, statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. And Delaney, do you think lawmakers now move up the date for appointing the superintendent from 2025 to 21?
You know, what it does for education policy, there is no education policy, okay? I mean, we had this State Board of Education established by Mike Pence because Glenda Ritz was elected and she was a Democrat. Now nobody's in charge of education. The testing, the standards change more frequently than Mike O'Brien changes his socks. It's ridiculous. And nobody's in charge. Nobody is in charge, which is why the system is in chaos. She's absolutely right. I give her credit for standing up and calling it the way it is. That Board of Education should be dissolved, and either we have a superintendent who's in charge of education policy, or it goes to the governor. But this nonsense in between, where no one's in charge, means that the system can continue to fail and nobody's held accountable. So I think she did the right thing.
Is all of this then solved once we start just appointing the superintendent?
Well, two things. One, I give her credit for saying this well in advance, because these are decisions that have to be made. I mean, if you're going to go and try to find somebody to recruit sooner than you might have otherwise would have, if you have to think about how to restructure your approach to the election in 2020, assuming before this that the superintendent was definitely going to be elected. Even if she ran or not, that it would definitely be an elected position. This helps kind of manage those moving parts coming into the legislative session. But the attacks on—I don't know what unhealthy means in her mind, but it's certainly disjointed. And I think both parties have agreed for two decades now that it's disjointed, and it should be rolled in an appointed position where you have the power of the executive branch behind education policy instead of kind of this separate authority. This separate elected official, where the politics are still, the legislature is still accountable for education policy and education funding from a political standpoint. The governor's still responsible politically. Voters are going to hold him accountable for the outcomes, and I think that was the motivation going back to when Joe Kernan and Mitch Daniels ran against each other and both agreed this needs to happen. So I hope it happens sooner than later. I think it makes it easier now. I think the motivation to push it out to 2025 was So you're not taking away, voters' decision, or changing the process midstream on somebody. Making sure everyone knew the rules up front, and then we appoint somebody.
Well, the Senate defeated the bill the first time around, so they had to change it substantially to get it passed.
But I think one of the key things here is that it is going to go into effect right now, the appointed position. So really, why not move it up at this point? Because who are you going to get? What kind of good, qualified candidate are you going to get who knows that not only is the position going away as it exists today in 4 years, but at some point you become just a lame duck. I mean, it's just, doesn't seem like it would make a lot of sense to do it that way. But I think the structure could still be a problem, even once you appoint that person, because you've still got this board over here. And even though the governor appoints that board, you've still got a board with a mind of their own who's been given a tremendous amount of authority. And so I can foresee an appointed superintendent and even a governor struggling to deal with a board that has that much authority and is not elected.
So, you know, but there was a lot of alignment between Tony Bennett and the board. I mean,
the board has been empowered since Tony Bennett left.
No, the board was different.
The leadership, the power structure of the board changed. You're right about that.
But not only the power structure, but the actual programs that they put under the board to implement.
Oh, that's right. So we used
to have all of them implemented over here, and we've slowly moved a bunch of them over here, but not all of them. So we have basically two different education agencies working right now. And just because he appoints someone doesn't mean, you know, they appoint, but you can't remove that person. So what if that person then starts conflicting again with that board? I mean, that part is still going to be there.
Well, but those are all creations of the legislature, so you can always go back and have those debates.
Well, you can always abolish the board. And Leslie's right. It's not just recruiting somebody to run. Recruiting somebody to serve in an appointed capacity when the current superintendent has said she's powerless is going to be a little difficult.
I want to ask both you and you this question then. She talked about Hoosiers deserve a voice in education policy. Yes, you could vote for the governor, but are people voting for the governor on education policy over all the other things the governor does?
I think it's a significant reason that people vote for the governor. I think it's harder now when you've got this massive bureaucracy in the way for holding him accountable for this. I think it's a lot better than having, for example, the chairman of the Education Committee for the House be a charter school advocate because he's employed by Marion College. I mean, those kinds of things and those kinds of conflicts need to be resolved in an elected official who is clearly held accountable for what that policy is. We don't have that now.
And whether it's 2021 or 2025, moving the superintendent to an appointed position by the governor, they would also obviously continue to appoint the board. Does that even enhance how much education will be a focus in future gubernatorial elections?
It could, but I think if you're looking at how voters draw a straight line from the issue to who's accountable for it on the ballot and how they make that decision in the next election, you know, they're going to make that decision, but they may make it on DCS, they may make it on Medicaid, they may make it on road funding, they may make it on environmental policy or energy policy, the other, like, gigantic policy areas that are under the executive branch. Right. So I don't think it's going to be a problem that the executive branch have the capacity and the willingness to take on those big issues.
But to that point, though.
I think it absolutely changes future governor's races.
I do, too.
No doubt. If you look across the nation at places where the governor is essentially in charge of education, it is a huge part of a lot of those governor's races. The governor does get blamed for teacher salaries, even though we have a different system in Indiana where it's determined locally, but all of the funding decisions, all of that comes back to rest on the governor, and it makes me wonder if some future governors might think, oh, I wish this had never happened.
Well, maybe they would like to have a structure where they actually had control of it. And maybe they'd want to do something like increase the teacher salaries that have been eroding over the years.
Yeah, a lot of that really rests with the legislatures. So that,
well, yeah. Local,
well, yeah, but the governor can direct that.
And local school.
It all rests with the legislature,
yeah.
You know, ultimately. But the governor has a lot of authority on how he manages those agencies.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, Democratic Secretary of State candidate Jim Harper this week said Republican incumbent Connie Lawson shouldn't accept campaign donations from auto dealers. The Indiana Secretary of State's office oversees auto dealers, and auto dealers and their organization have given current Secretary Connie Lawson about $250,000 in campaign contributions since she took office. Democratic candidate Jim Harper says that raises a red flag. Harper says Secretary of State office holders and candidates should be barred from accepting contributions from auto dealers. Connie Lawson says she doesn't see a problem. She views the contributions as proof auto dealers are happy with the work she's done. Harper notes he received a donation from the auto dealers trade group and will donate it to charity. Mike O'Brien, Harper is not necessarily saying that Lawson has actually done something wrong. He's talking about appearance, and as we know in politics, appearance matters a lot. So does this look bad enough that it warrants some sort of limited campaign finance reform?
Well, first, look at what he did. He took that contribution and said, I don't want this contribution, and then he cashed the check, and then he deposited, and then he gave someone else's money to a charity, and then held a press conference to try to take credit for all of it. So that little scam, I have no, it gets no points for me.
$250,000 went to Connie Lawson.
The amounts here.
No,
are
I get
different.
It, but it's the Democrats' way. They take someone else's money, give it to charity, and claim credit for it. So I'm not giving them any points for that. But you're right. The relevant policy question here is: should you be able to draw a straight line between the contribution and the person who is running for office and regulates that industry? And that happens. That happens all the time, right? So I mean, it's a legit policy question from a campaign finance standpoint. I personally prefer I think the problem we've seen at the federal government, we put a lot of restrictions on who can give money, how much they can give, and it's created this kind of dark money universe where we have these, you know, in the Senate race here is a great example. Those campaigns combined are going to get out and spent 2-3 to 1 with money that no Hoosier knows where it came from. So if you start saying, well, if you regulate auto dealers, you can't contribute to the Secretary of State's, or if you're an auto dealer, you can't contribute to the Secretary of State's office, you affirm kind of the underlying premise that, in the most negative sense, that all of this is bought and paid for. These outcomes are purchased during the campaign, and then they're executed during governance. And you can find some high-profile examples where that's true. It's mostly not. And I think those of us that work in this industry know that that's not the case. I prefer just total transparency. Let voters make the decision.
And under Harper's theory, wouldn't you then want to, like, ban everybody from giving money to the legislature? Because the legislature regulates everybody?
I mean, I think Connie Lawson's been in the State House too long, because her answer to this was that the entity that she's regulating is quite pleased with what she's done, and that's why they're contributing. She's supposed to be representing consumers in this, not the automobile industry, number one. Number two is, you're right to a certain extent, but the dark money comes from the Citizens United case that the Republican Supreme Court passed, which has completely destroyed campaign finance reform, completely destroyed it, and made it.
And no Congress under either party has tried again. You know, they haven't tried to do it again.
That's true.
Well, that's because Republicans control it. Well, and they think money speaks, and money has a First Amendment right.
Yeah, the Democratic Congress didn't do it either after the Citizens United case.
So you've got that. I mean, I really think she ought to think twice about it, as I do think in the legislature. You can see time and time again where committee chairs who regulate certain industries get the bulk of their financing from it. I actually thought a long time.
I mean, this is a slippery slope. I mean, you know, the Secretary of State also is our chief elections officer. Can she not take anything from election vendors? Can the Attorney General not accept money from lawyers who he might face in a lawsuit or a court? Can legislators not take money? I mean, they're rewriting alcohol
who would the governor
right now. Publicly financed
who
campaigns.
Would the governor ever be able to take money?
Right.
That's the point
I'm trying to make. Is it's still going to cost $20 million to go run a governor's campaign. And if you pass a law that says you can't take any money from people that do business with state government, you're going to force this money to go somewhere else to run a campaign that sits on top of these traditional campaigns.
I mean,
and
I
as a campaign guy, I'm more of a I'm not for that.
Are you for public financing of campaigns?
I don't know if I'm not ready to go that far. I'm certainly not for a super PAC dumping $70 million into Indiana.
But I agree.
I mean, on either side.
This would be a lot easier to deal with.
Well, hopefully more people would watch this and get educated so we wouldn't have to raise so much money and spend so much money.
But it would be a lot easier for voters if it was easy to see where campaign money comes from.
Yeah.
The first thing that we need to do is have a portal that makes it super easy for people to see where money comes from.
It's easy now. It's just time consuming. It's not easy.
It's easy for us because we do it all the time. It's not easy for someone who's
If you know where you're looking, it's easy.
Yeah.
If you don't know where to look,
then it's impossible.
I agree with that.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: should Secretary of State office holders and candidates be barred from accepting campaign contributions from auto dealers who the office oversees? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question: will Vice President Mike Pence have an impact on Indiana's Senate race? 23% say he'll help Mike Braun, 14% say he'll hurt Mike Braun, and 63% say he won't have an impact. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the White House this week announced a new trade deal with Mexico and Canada, replacing the 25-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement. President Trump called the deal a campaign promise kept. The agreement between the three North American countries will shield Canada from automobile tariffs, and it requires cars from Mexico to include more North American-made parts if they're to be sold duty-free in the U.S. U.S. dairy farmers will have more access to the Canadian market, and the deal updates NAFTA with more digital trade and intellectual property provisions. The agreement must be ratified by Congress. President Trump expressed confidence it would be, then later in the same press conference said he was not at all confident Congress would approve the deal.
Leslie Weidenbender, is this the biggest win of the Trump administration?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. The question will be, though, whether the agriculture community, whether manufacturers actually feel like it was a great deal down the road, because if the trade war continues with China and other countries, they might not be able to differentiate what kind of impact there was from the North American Free Trade, from the New Deal.
The New Deal, the from USMCA.
Yeah, exactly. But I think
I don't know if Republicans will love the idea of calling it New Deal, but
that's a good point.
We'll call it USCRUB, come on. I think that
a lot of people would have said that he wasn't going to be able to strike a deal like this, and he went out and did it. So, yeah, I think of the things that he can really talk about doing, this is one of the big ones.
We're not talking a lot about the Senate race on the show this week, but I am going to talk about it a little bit here, which is, does this boost Mike Braun, who said all along, I trust the president to do the right thing? Is that message paying off with this sort of deal?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely plays into what he said, which is give the president time, and, you know, we're going to have some initial pains, but then we're going to have some victory and some success and changes in the end. So it definitely helps him.
Yeah, I thought his biggest accomplishment was taking the nuclear weapons out of North Korea. What happened to that? I haven't seen any developments
on
that.
But this is a big win for the
president. Well, he's changed the name, and he's tweaked the NAFTA, and NAFTA needed tweaking. There's no question about it. But what happens the next time a factory moves to Mexico? Who does he blame then? He's been screaming about NAFTA for 2 years now. Is it Hillary Clinton's fault? Is it the deep state? It's going to happen, okay? It's going to happen. Those outsourcing jobs are going to continue, and I just want to know who he's going to blame then.
I can't wait to find out.
It'll be somebody. It'll be somebody's fault.
To Leslie's point, which is really an interesting one, this is obviously a win for the Trump administration and hopefully the country, but will it be enough that the average Hoosier notices?
Well, maybe if they waited a couple weeks. It's a bad week to try to make big news on policy, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I think the people that care about this in the auto, we have a lot of people employed in the auto industry. We have a lot of people employed by agriculture. To Ann's point, we'll wait and see. I mean, they've tried to turn the dials on, you know, percent of American
parts,
labor,
right,
and parts, and whether that creates incentives to grow some of the big auto manufacturing facilities we have in Indiana remains to be seen. I think they were smart in putting kind of a look back in here, so that in a couple of years they can look back and say, is this working the way we thought it did? And if it didn't, then they have this window to renegotiate.
Does it get it through Congress? In the same press conference, he said yes and no.
Well, I think it depends which Congress it goes before.
that's an excellent point. Well,
maybe you better pray for a Democrat one.
The state panel responsible for examining Indiana's alcohol laws says local communities should get to decide whether to add more alcohol permits to their area. It's part of the final recommendations of the 2-year study commission. State law restricts how many alcohol permits are allowed in each community. Currently, if a city wants more, the General Assembly has to pass legislation specific to each area. The Alcohol Code Revision Commission unanimously recommends what it sees as a better approach, a ballot referendum in any community that wants to increase its quota. The commission also recommends the state limit how long someone can hold a new permit without using it. The current cap is about 7 years. The commission's unanimous recommendation would lower that to 3 years. The commission last year recommended the removal of the Sunday alcohol sales prohibition, but in neither year could it decisively recommend an expansion of cold beer sales. Nikki Kelly, 2 years, about a dozen meetings, many of which you and I covered. Should Hoosiers be happy with the commission's work?
Well, I think Hoosiers who wanted more options to buy cold beer are not going to be happy. But clearly the Sunday sales thing from last year was the heavy lift that legislators were okay with, and they, you know, promptly backed completely away from the cold beer discussion. A lot of what they've been discussing now, your average consumer is not going to feel or see the impact. I mean, they are important issues within the weeds of the industry, but I doubt we see much that a consumer would really appreciate out of it.
I'm curious about this local election sort of twist to
Well, I actually do think that is the one place where there could be some impact, because there are places, especially in Hamilton County, other fast-growing places, where there really aren't enough liquor permits to accommodate the growth that a lot of these communities want to promote, or that are already, I mean, there's really a cap already on the kind of growth that can happen in retail areas for restaurants. And so it could make a big difference there. I think that you'll see that there will be several places where voters are perfectly willing to go along with this, even though you should expect to see campaigns against it by those people who already own liquor permits.
Well, there's that. There's those folks who will probably be opposed to it. And there's also the, and you find them everywhere in every place in this country, the not in my backyard crowd, the sort of, if you want to call them anti-growth crowd, who aren't comfortable with that sort of thing. How much is a public question healthy in that debate?
We'll find out. I'm from Hendricks County, so I'm from a fast-growing, one of these fast-growing communities. I was Hendricks County GOP chairman for 8 years, and you saw at the local level, you have these candidates running who have been there for 100 years and who have been there for 6 months, and they want the new brewery on the corner, and the guy who lives in the farm across the street doesn't, right? It's a very interesting dynamic in some of these growing communities, because some of these people just don't want more growth. They may not want that kind of growth. I mean, imagine if Fishers had to go to referendum on whether to build Topgolf or not. You know, I mean, you might get into those situations where now you're like running campaigns to go open a new winery, you know, or something like that. So it could be interesting.
Don't you think it's possible that restaurants, though, are different? Because even a lot of people who may be more anti-growth, restaurants are something kind of everybody can appeals to everybody versus like an IKEA.
Yeah, that's gonna,
sure.
Like a versus an IKEA or a shopping center.
But I think that is,
you know,
Chili's in 2019.
right. But I think they tried to address what's a real problem, which is there's not enough permits in these areas, and
so
people move to those areas.
Why
for
can't
those
the market control this? I thought that's what all of you guys stood for. Let the market factors work, okay? And if they, there's a need for those additional facilities, then they'll have patrons and it'll flourish. If not, they'll fold.
Because of the way, I think the answer is, and we saw it kind of exposed in this debate, was how people have acquired permits over the years. And the cost disparity, the differential, and some are worth $250,000 and some worth $1,500 bucks.
So let's buy them out. Let's buy them
out.
And
that was
talked
about.
And that was talked about. But it is a problem.
Instead of spending it on DCS, and that's what you
no,
would
say. I instead of giving another corporate tax break, I'd pay them off.
But this is a problem when the when government creates these rules and they create these inequities in the system, then down the line go, all right, we got to level this and make it all equal and open, and the people who invested go, wait a minute. I just played by the rules, right?
I mean, let's face it, we need to let the market control.
This is the very issue that you're talking about, this historical problem where these some of the licenses have gotten very valuable. It's exactly why this hasn't been taken care of years before. I mean, this has been hanging around for decades.
So I'll ask, I want to go quickly around, because you answered this question, but I didn't get it from the other three because we were talking about the other issue. 2 years of work. They got, so far, they've only gotten Sunday sales. We'll see what the legislature does with this year's recommendations. But the rest of the recommendations from last year's commission did not get through the legislature. So should Hoosiers be happy with the commission's work?
I think people mostly cared about Sunday sales, so I would say yes.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I can polish them and the Alcoholic Beverage Commission. Okay?
All right. Well,
small government and delaying.
Actually,
back
yeah.
again.
Congress failed to pass a new farm bill this week, meaning the previous measure lapsed, leaving Hoosier farmers uncertain as they plan for next year. The farm bill includes everything from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, food stamps, to crop insurance and providing farmers education and technical support. The Indiana Farm Bureau says not having those resources, on top of low market prices due to high yields and the president's trade war, hurts farmers trying to get ready for next season and beyond. One sticking point is House Republicans' desire to add work requirements for SNAP. That's the largest segment of the bill, though the law also funds a variety of programs that help agricultural workers across the country. Mike O'Brien, the farm bill has typically been seen in a bipartisan way as a necessity. So how does this happen?
Because everything's hard in Washington, D.C. right now. Honestly, I think this is one area where they're actually working on a bipartisan basis and actually talking to each other. So, so let's not,
discount that as a victory,
right?
Yeah.
They have till the end of the year to get there. I think they wanted to keep, I'm a little surprised, but they wanted to keep the pressure on by not doing an extension for the next 3 months and then trying to start kicking the can. And now this is the next kind of budget process where we don't ever have a farm bill. We just have 6 month, you know, extensions. But farmers are in a tough spot right now. I mean, they've got high yields, at least in Indiana.
Yeah.
They've got low prices.
They're trying to navigate
this tariff issue.
Way out, too.
And they're in Indiana, they're a factor in the election. So we'll see how they react.
And they all voted reliably for Trump. And this is how he repays them. You know, it's
well, do you put this one on the president, or is this one more on Congress?
It's his party. He has control of both houses. If there was some leadership here, it seems to me something that's always been bipartisan in the past could have gotten passed.
Well, finally, President Trump this week, in addressing sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, said there are, quote, bad reports about everybody except for Vice President Mike Pence. So, Ann Delaney, would an allegation against Pence be, as Trump put it, the greatest shock of all time?
If he holds himself up as the gold standard on this. I mean, compared to Donald Trump, I think you could say Mike Pence is a choir boy. But I don't think the standard of holding that president up as a model for young people in this country is a good one. I think that's a disgrace.
In politics today, would there be a more shocking allegation than one against Mike Pence?
Unless you're offended by a firm handshake, you're not going to find much of this on
Plus, he doesn't Mike Pence, dine but, or hang out with women by himself.
That's
so
right.
It'd be
hard. The Pence rule clearly playing a role. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, Leslie Weidenbender of the Indianapolis Business Journal, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/iwir, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.